The House Committee on Education Subcommittee on Higher Education for Monday, March 26, 2007. Welcome to all. A gentle reminder, if anyone here has a cell phone, please turn it off, not just down, because it will interfere with the sound system in this hearing room. We are fortunate to have today, now, is this our last university that's come to talk to us?
Mr. Chair, we have trying to reschedule Portland State University.
Portland State University.
Canceled the other day due to a late floor session.
That's right. We've tried to have everybody in, and we're very, very happy to have Dr. Joseph Robertson, the president of Oregon Health and Science University, with us to give us a update on what's going on with OHSU. So please, Dr. Robertson, if you would, an open informational hearing on Oregon Health and Science University.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, I'm delighted to be here today. And for the record, my name is Joe Robertson. My position is president of Oregon Health and Science University. Again, thank you for this opportunity. As I was telling Chair Buckley when we begin, there's nothing that I like better to do than to discuss my favorite topic and my favorite institution. We very much appreciate the support that we've received from the legislature, past and present, and we certainly want to acknowledge that we always realize that it is difficult as you face your decision and contemplate the distribution of funds with the many needs that come before you. Having said that, we will do our best job to continue to advocate for the programs that we think are not only strong but essential for the well-being of the state. I have open admission, too many slides, so please don't fear. I am not going to dwell on many of them. The schedule here has changed some since I originally started to put this together, so I will hit the highlights, and we've provided you with copies of all of the rest, and if you have further questions, we would love to answer them. This isn't showing up on here. Our mission is, I think you're quite familiar with it, the mission and vision. I think were actually included in Senate Bill 2, so I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on that. I think the important thing to realize is that we are a multifaceted university, and we have a multifaceted mission. Again, I think you are probably familiar with this, but healing, teaching, discovery, and service, and we take all four components very seriously. As the way we function is as a health system, as our various academic units, various research centers, and various community outreach programs that reach every county in the state. We have now over 3,500 students and trainees. I think this is maybe more than many people realize. For instance, in the School of Medicine, we actually have more types of learners now than medical students if you combine the persons that are in our other graduate programs. We also have roughly 1,000 people engaged in various training after graduation from medical school, as well as tens of thousands of health professionals each year that are involved in our continuing medical education programs. There are four schools that are contained solely within OHSU, and then the College of Pharmacy, which is a joint program with Oregon State University and Allied Health programs in conjunction with OIT. Again, this group is quite familiar, I think, with the history, but Senate Bill 2 in 1995 was very important in that it created the public corporation that I think has been instrumental in much of our subsequent success. Today, just in the past month, we've passed over 12,000 employees, now Portland's largest employer, fourth largest in Oregon, with an operating budget exceeding $1.2 billion. Again, we think we are very much and a very important part of Oregon's economic engine, and that we do continue to fuel that engine. We like to certainly talk about these economic factors, but I always hope that when we do that, they will not be the major or sole focus. I think this is a byproduct of our primary mission, which is to improve the health and well-being of all Oregonians and all Oregon communities. This is one of many ways of showing what really has been nothing short of almost astronomical growth over the past three decades. And Of all the slides that I'm going to show today, this is one of the handful that I really want to point out for you to take note of, and that is you will see the not only marks but the sustained rate of growth of this institution, particularly over the past decade and a half in each of the tripart, in each of our missions. And we have not only achieved that growth, but we have subsequently obtained excellence in each of the units. There are many bragging type slides that we could show. We'll show but a few. We have multiple programs in the School of Medicine that are ranked in the top in the country. We're well into the 20s, sometimes, depending upon when the rankings are taken, the 24th in the country in NIH funding. The School of Dentistry is known across the country for the quality of its clinical programs, and School of Nursing, besides having these tremendous GPAs among the applicants, has all of its graduate programs represented in the top 10 as they're ranked across the country. We've achieved similar success in the clinical arena, earning the Consumer Choice Award in Portland for 7 years in a row. Then showing the financial side of that growth, and I think you will see how the curve here appreciably steepens following the creation of the public corporation there in the mid-90s. And you can also see here the coupling of the growth of the academic portion of the institution with the clinical arm. Again, this is one of the key concepts that I want to underscore. Keeping that balance is very important. Research awards have also grown, reaching now, this year we will surpass $300 million, and I just had a chance to look at our updated figures before I left for Salem today, and we are continuing to grow at nearly 5% a year despite a flattening of the NIH budget over the past several years, which is a remarkable feat compared to our competing or comparable institutions. The past year has been one of marked growth that where we have opened three new buildings, roughly 1 million square feet of space, that we hope will give us capacity in the short term to continue to grow. And without going into the details, the tram is functioning well and I think is working well and is considered a success. I stopped by on a bike ride, in fact, on Saturday, only to find long lines, people queuing up, and each of the cars full. It's been a great delight to see. I've spoken about the marked growth of OHSU over the past two decades, and here we look back basically a decade and a half and show that concurrent with that growth has been diminishing state support in what we call the operating budget. The Oregon Opportunity was a tremendous one-time investment that allowed us to build some new buildings and launch new programs, but you can see that overall the state allocation that contributes to the fundamental support, or what we call our operating budget, has diminished at the same time as this remarkable growth. How have we been able to sustain that? There has been a transfer of significant revenues from the clinical enterprise to the academic enterprise, and here you see that in graphic form, and we have used the clinical enterprise basically to support the academic enterprise. Over the long term, this could potentially place us at a potential disadvantage compared to other health systems, because other health systems have been able to invest this in such things as buying and developing primary care networks. Access to capital was a critical factor in the formation of the public corporation, and if you will note here and add up all that's in the blue and the yellow, and add them up individually, while our clinical revenues generally exceed our academic revenues, you will see that we have invested disproportionately in the academic side of the institution. We continue to care for those who are most underserved and underprivileged. This graph shows our relative comparison of the number of discharges that we fulfill in the four county area compared to other institutions, and then the degree of the non-compensated or undercompensated care that we provide. This slide seems to be very busy, but it shows the same information in a different way, and it shows OHSU relative to other institutions. It shows that the two institutions in the four county area that do by far the greatest proportional amount of the non-sponsored and under-sponsored care are Legacy Emmanuel and OHSU, with OHSU doing by far and away the largest percentage proportional to the number of discharges. I can also say that since we've opened the new space, I just recently reviewed the numbers over the past 4 months, the absolute number of indigent patients that we have served since opening the new facilities this summer has continued to increase. Unfortunately, this comes at a financial cost. Again, not sufficient time to go into the detail, but you will see here year after year, this is a cost to the institution that runs into the tens of millions of dollars. If we slice our operating budget into pieces of the pie, the state appropriation appears to be slightly less than 3%. What I don't want you to go away with is the false perception of about the lack of the importance of that 3%, because that 3% contributes to the academic programs that otherwise we would have no way to fund. And these are academic programs that will never, despite whatever our goals might be, but even being the most efficient possible, will never be self-sustaining. So the state support is absolutely critical. It supports education, our community, and our community outreach. It does not support the clinical enterprise. I wanted to just take a few of my remaining minutes to look forward, and I think as an institution and as a state, the greatest crisis that we face in healthcare is that of the healthcare workforce shortage that we are beginning to experience and will be experiencing to a greater degree over the next 1 to 2 decades. This really overshadows almost everything else that we encounter. This the former slide there showed the marked aging of the population. This slide shows how we continue to use an ever-increasing percentage of healthcare resources as we age. You combine the two, you see there that the demand will unfortunately at current rates of production of providers outstrip the supply. Our physician force is also aging at the same rate as the rest of the patient population, and this was a study completed in 2004 predicting that over 1,200 physicians would leave the workforce in Oregon in the next 2 years while we were graduating roughly 200 students. This shows the diminishing ratio of physicians to 100,000 of the population, and the most distressing aspect of this with regard to Oregon is that we are only producing physicians at half the rate as of the national average. The voters now believe that there are too few physicians and that this will worsen. This is a slide that shows the relative support of the western states for medical education. We are at the bottom in each of those category, whether speaking about absolute numbers or dollars per student. Similar data can be shown for the in each of the other schools. Here we show the impending workforce issue in dentistry. Also show that of all the 37 dental schools across the country, it is second from the bottom in the degree of state support. Nursing picture, we have markedly increased the number of nursing graduates, but we have seen that we have only managed to diminish the rate of separation of the curves between supply and demand and have not been able to actually close the gap. And just as a quick aside, this is not restricted to the healthcare professions. We see in a broader sense this relates to this is doctorate degrees in science across the country. So we have a very major concern about pipeline issues. We have gained, in fact, recognition on a national scale for our creative efforts to try and address this issue. particularly as it relates to trying to develop programs at regional sites. And we have continued to increase the number of students and have been successful in doing that in an incremental way. And overall, our plan over the long term is to do this in a distributive manner and work with other institutions around the state and not have medical education be located solely on Markham Hill. I would be happy to delve into that, but that's a much larger discussion, and I don't think I should do that since I'm just trying to provide an oversight. Our area health education program is essential to providing services in underserved areas, and it's also a key component of that regional education program as we work not only to distribute services around the state, but work to recruit a broader representation of Oregonians into the healthcare professions. The revenue challenges, as all parties that come to Salem, I am certain to share those. Again, the greatest one is that in some ways one of the unanticipated consequences of our success is with this marked expansion of programs, we have proportionately fewer and fewer dollars to support them. And as a classic example, we can see that as these buildings have gone up, we have to assume those depreciation schedules, so that actually contributes to an overall overhead expense for all of our programs. We have embarked upon a strategic planning process. This has been quite involved. We've tried to involve all of the stakeholders. The real bottom line is we're trying to define what OHSU should look like in 2020. Again, we haven't changed the vision or mission statement. A very succinct summary of that strategic planning is that our goal is for OHSU to make Oregon a national leader in health and science innovation for the purpose of improving the health and well-being of all Oregonians. And you will see a very aspirational component to that. There's the aspiration to greatness, but there's also a very marked and purposeful reference to our local stakeholders. And we want to achieve excellence on a national and international scale, but have the effect felt directly here at home. We think we're in a position to do that. Our operating budget will be the greatest challenge. We will have to continue our efforts to enhance diversity. This again is critically important if you're going to treat and care for a diverse patient population. One of our core concepts and our core beliefs is that we have to work together and collaborate not only within the institution but outside the institution. This is our simplistic model of saying that we may never be the biggest academic health center in the country, but we do want to be the best. And one area where we particularly aspire to be the best is working at the interface of disciplines. We believe that it's at the interface of disciplines where great discoveries often occur, and we want our faculty thinking about all of our missions concurrently. As an example, we can't imagine that our clinicians would be busy seeing patients without collecting the data that could be used for evidence-based medicine and enhancing outcomes. This, of course, is you run this concept by a consultant and you get a much fancier picture, and this shows how the major goals that we have achieved across all of our enterprises. Just a few quick words before I close. As we look forward, we also look toward the waterfront, but we actually look much beyond that. The tram and our move to the waterfront really is just a metaphor of how OHSU is trying to get off the hill and extend itself into the community, in fact, all 96,000 square miles of Oregon. But we do have the chance, ultimately, the pace was yet to be determined, but we ultimately do have the chance to build an interdisciplinary campus on this site that was provided to us by the Stitzer campus, the Stitzer family, that will embody our ideals. And those ideals are for us to be interdisciplinary and transprofessional in our training. All the quality data shows that if you're going to have quality outcomes, people need to work together and work as teams and communicate. We think that needs to begin while you're in your educational programs. You don't train people in silos and then graduate them and tell them magically to work together. And we also think there will be an economy of scale that will be achieved if we integrate these programs. And this sort of space station-looking drawing there is, again, a rendering of how those interdisciplinary components would come together. And this is but a glimpse. We don't know what this campus will look like, but we think that it will be unique. Nobody in the history of academic medicine has really had the chance to get 20 new acres in an urban environment and approach this in a transprofessional manner and basically redefine the concept of an academic health center and how education should be provided. So that is my brief overview. We hope that if we are successful in achieving our vision for 2020, we won't just say, Oregon, things are different here, but Oregon, because of OHSU, things are better here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roberts.
Questions, really? Anyone lead off?
No questions? There's an agreement.
Yeah. Hi, Joe. Thank you for coming.
I'm absolutely
glad the committee got a chance to meet you. We had a hearing, I think, last week on some possible changes for the university. And I was wondering if you could talk about what you saw as the possible advantages and the possible disadvantages of what's now OHSU being an academic health center in a larger urban university.
Be delighted to.
You know that's not a surprise, but you and I have talked about it many times.
Yeah. And I think the first thing is that the first thing out of my mouth is that it is a laudatory goal. And I also very much appreciate your bringing this forward and having us take a look at this. One of the key elements, in fact, of our strategic plan, as you really delve into it, is to say, how do we collaborate with others, not only to do things in a novel manner, but the goal, I think, of everybody here is to how do we best leverage the resources in Oregon to do the best for our community. And I think all of us are united in that goal. There would be nothing that I personally would enjoy more than working toward making the two institutions fully integrated and perhaps even one. And just as a very brief aside, that if you look at my own professional history, history will document that. I was the first person as a retina specialist to put a community-wide call schedule together. Then when we built the KCI Institute, we opened it up to community providers. When Legacy and OHSU were fighting on the front page of the Oregonian about hearts and kidneys, we essentially erected a virtual institute between KCI Institute endeavors, and I've invested much of my energy over the past several years into this regional medical education program where we worked with other health systems and other universities, again, not to just train students in Portland, but to try and use all of our collective resources to do a better job and to do it economically. So I would enjoy that type. I mean, that's the type of thing that gets me excited when I get up in the morning. However, there are some very real constraints that I think we face at this particular time. Those constraints are that we are very focused in several key areas. Those key areas are we are still trying to optimize the return on the Oregon opportunity that the state has invested in. We are also hopefully maintaining this laser-like focus on the workforce issues that confront us. If you look at our policy option packages, every package that we brought forward this year attempts to address that workforce issue. And that wasn't because we don't have lots of other concerns, lots of other programs, lots of other faculty advocating for other things, but that was our concern. The other is we are, as I mentioned in some of the presentation here, currently we're most stressed or stretched in our operational budget, and that is because of the growth. I don't think any of us that were are in leadership positions anticipated back in 1995 that as we grew this much, our state support would diminish to the degree that it has. Now, again, I want to be very clear that we are appreciative of what we receive, and we understand that you face the same type of challenges that we do in the allocation of resources. But it is a very real concern. And we have been able to, we have managed to do that, again, by that bringing over the transfer from the clinical side to the academic side, that revenue. And that's what I fear, probably of everything I fear, it is the disruption of that clinical support of the academic enterprise, because we have become very efficient, actually, as a public corporation, as a different type of academic health center that is focused on education, research, and healthcare. And we have done that with the consent of the faculty, who, as an example, if you look at our medical group, there's a 7.8% assessment on all gross revenues that goes to support the academic activities. Beyond that, of the dollars that remain, 34% of them are transferred from the clinical enterprise, this is in the physician practice group, to the academic enterprise. And my concern is that moving forward in this regard would be a threat, because I don't think that our faculty could continue to transfer as much or even more than they are. And I'm very concerned, probably my greatest concern in this whole venture, is about faculty flight. I mean, we are in a very precarious position. We are very dependent upon that clinical revenue. And if there is a very sincere interest here, I mean, I came to this today knowing this question would come. So I tried to think, among other things, what would it take to make this, I think, in the minds of the faculty, because it's one thing for us to talk about it. What we don't understand, if we can't convince the faculty that this is a good idea, they have highly transferable job skills, and more so today than ever before because of the workforce issue. So if the goal is to make this happen, the goal is not to convince this group or me or anybody, it's to convince the faculty that it is a good idea. And they're going to see that it's a good idea if it means that there will be more resources for their programs. If they perceive it in any way as stretching or diluting those resources, and right now, again, don't shoot the messenger here, but the history as they look back is that these two things that are so marked, that were so pivotal to our success, the creation of the public corporation and the Oregon Opportunity, have been accompanied by continuing cuts in the operating budget. So in the faculty's mind, their perception is that history would repeat itself. So if there is serious intent about this, and I think there is, and we want to talk about it in a constructive manner, then I think a way to begin to do that is to have several years pick something that's very demonstrable. Okay. And I showed you the amount of the relative support of each medical school. Support the medical school to the average of the 17 Western states, or something like this, where there is a clear demonstration to the faculty that the intent is to enhance the resources rather than to seek something that will ultimately make them contribute to an even greater degree. I mean, and if so, that would be my trying to think about this in a constructive manner. I think that would be the thing that could be done to try and get the faculty on board, is something that would be concrete with regard to enhancing support.
Mr. Chair, just a note. Joe, thank you for your even-handed remarks. When you're talking about the faculty in this case, you're mostly focusing, I think, on the faculty that produce clinical income rather than the faculty that produce research income, which is another important contribution to the whole.
Oh, yes. Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick, absolutely. And what I was doing, I mean, there are, all of the faculty have to be considered. But I think right now, if we cause flight in any of the faculty, research or clinical, because we have built up both on this basis, and our even the research faculty, okay, we recruited many of them with the Oregon opportunity, but if they leave, as you so well know, we don't recruit them with just the annual support. It takes a package of many times that to bring them back.
I never got that. It's I want it on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative.
Oh, I was there before the Oregon opportunity, but
it's an opportunity.
All I got was the ability to be a chair and not collect a salary. That's not a good thing.
Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Robertson. And my question is, you have three goals, one clinical, education, and research. And I think I understand the clinical and education, but what your OHSU did concerning the research. Some time ago, maybe a long time ago, I heard that the cloning is done in your OHSU, but that I don't hear much of the outstanding research work from the OHSU. Can you give us some information?
Oh, I would be, again, delighted to. That was, actually, I probably went over it very quickly. That was one of the reasons that I showed the slide that has in the School of Medicine. In fact, we have 7 to 9 programs that, if you look across the country, of all 126 medical schools that are ranked in the top 10 departments across the country in acquiring NIH dollars. And in science, there is no end-all be-all as it comes to, you know, evaluating science. Much of that is subjective, and it's often dependent upon which discipline you're in. You know, people in different disciplines have varying opinions of people's work in other disciplines. Usually they think the best work is done in their own. So sort of one of the proxies that is used for the success is the number of NIH dollars, and we have markedly ascended that ladder. I think, again, if you go back to the mid-80s, we were barely on the charts, or probably somewhere in the 60s to 80s. So our ascent has been among the most rapid, if not the most rapid, in the country. We also have a number of charts that will show the number of companies that are spin-outs, or that have come out of the OHSU funded research. But our overall pursuit is for excellence, and what we are looking for, and we're looking for that whether it is within the institution or across institutions. I have here actually a two-page summary, a small print of the things that we are doing with PSU. So what we're looking for is excellence in each discipline and excellence as it relates to health. If you want a specific, as an example of what might happen to OHSU over the longer term, let's look at what happened with OGI. Okay. If you go back and look at OGI 5 to 10 years ago, it had a diverse portfolio of research interests. Its research portfolio now is much more focused on health, and its funding has shifted to the to be predominantly NIH for its extramural funding. What we see there is a coupling then of basic research and a health orientation, and that goes back to the slide that we showed. We want our basic researchers talking to our clinicians. So not only will we achieve excellence, that synergy will relate in those discoveries that will ultimately be translated into cures. Was that helpful?
Well, a little bit, but not quite.
I'd like to rephrase the question, Representative. Are you looking for specifics?
Yeah, and I'd like to know some kind of a result out of research. You have some spin-out, that the OGI, whatever, but I didn't find an outstanding research result out of the research OHSU has done, and if you give me some examples, and I do appreciate it.
Okay, for instance, I'll go in my own discipline. Perhaps two of the first six genes that were identified that relate to macular degeneration is a potentially blinding disorder that affects the back of the eye, the center part. Two out of the first six genes that were related to that were identified at OHSU. One of the first genes as it relates to glaucoma. The first gene therapy trial in all of Oregon, and the first gene therapy trial that happened in the eye throughout the world occurred at OHSU. There is a new clinical trial that's injecting substances into the eye that's never been done before to treat potentially blinding retinal and the layer behind it, degenerative disorders such as retinitis pigmentosa and all. If we can stop that degeneration, avoid blindness in infants that would otherwise become blind. In my own career over the past 20 years working in conjunction with the pediatric ophthalmologists, we have changed the course not only in Oregon but across the world of the way retinopathy of prematurity is treated. When I started my career, it was almost always blinding. Now many times there are certain treatments we can do at various phases.
This helps.
Thank you, Representative.
Neuroscience.
Representative Kremel.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And don't forget finding a cure for cancer.
Yep.
One of the things, just as a comment that I'm glad to see is that on page 37 at the bottom there, you noted that recruiting more Oregon students. That I'm very, very glad to see. But on page 29, I notice that when you're talking about where you're mentioning about physicians leaving practice for whatever reason, retirements and so on, and you mentioned that they're from 04 to 06, you will have graduated only 200 new positions. And, of course, that's before they decided to go on for their residency and whatever they're going to do. That's just out of medical school, they've got the MD degree, which they can't do as much with as they'd like to think they can. But anyway, what's your retention rate? Because earlier I also noted that there was somewhere in here where you said that you want to expand to 106. You're moving to 120 students a year of acceptance, and then moving to 160. So currently out of 120 students that are admitted and that accept seats at OHSU, how many of them will be retained and actually graduate at the end of 4 years? Or
Representative Buckley, I mean Chair Buckley, Representative Kremel, thank you. That's a great topic. I love to talk about workforce matters. We actually retain, if you look, and it's very difficult to gather this data because you have to pick at what point are you going to make your observation in a physician's career and say that they're captured. So given that, you know, that difficulty of looking at the data, we capture roughly 50% or slightly greater of our students end up practicing in Oregon. The average medical school across the country is only about 34%. So we are actually known for our capture rate. We also share your goal of accepting as many Oregonians as we can possibly accept. If you look at what's happened in our financial picture, as we went through and we raised tuition and we actually recruited more non-resident students, we were still not able to fill the gap that was created by the funding cuts that we have received. Our goal, again, is to, if we had, I've been asked this question by the Oregon Medical Association, and I said, if we had anywhere close to the same budget as the University of Washington, we would not only fill almost every seat with an Oregonian, we would do so free of tuition, okay, to put this into perspective. But finally, we will never be able to have all of our students be from Oregon because our accrediting body, the Liaison Committee on Medical Education, mandates, and appropriately so, that you recruit a diverse student student population. We would not be able to recruit a sufficiently diverse student population from Oregon at this time to create the atmosphere that you need to ensure that you're training people in an aura of cultural competency and train them to treat this diverse patient population. We currently have gone to 120. We've expanded the chassis through regional medical education. We hope to go through 160. I didn't mention this the first time through, but since you asked the question, that is currently not co-funded by the co-chair's budget. So we very much want to keep that alive. We will look forward to working with the legislature to find a way to make that happen and keep it on the shelf so we can implement it when the day becomes possible to fund it.
Thank you, Dr. Robertson. But I guess the crux of my question was I didn't ask how many state of practice, because it really is going to depend, I think, a lot on a student where they go for their residency, what their specialty is, and then if they desire to come back to Oregon after that. But if you have 120 students that are admitted, and for how many of that, what percentage or how many of them are going to actually graduate? Not necessarily that they'll stay in Oregon, not necessarily that they'll come back to Oregon. But
it will, on average, probably exceed 98%.
Yeah, they basically graduate.
Yeah.
Get rid of them once they get in. It's possible. I've tried.
Try to wash them out and it doesn't work.
Representative Lynn, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Dr. Robertson. In the page 29, it shows 1,255 physicians in Oregon will have left the workforce by 2006. Only OHSU will be graduating 200, which is a 6-to-1 in ratio. And is this showing all our state or just your OHSU only?
No. Chair Buckley, Representative Blim, that is across the state. And we have traditionally closed that gap by recruiting much of our workforce from outside the state. That will become increasingly difficult to do as the workforce shortage becomes exacerbated. The other reason that this is so skewed is that we have not increased the number of physicians nationwide or in Oregon since the late 70s to early 80s. Over the past 25 years, the number's been stable. So the workforce has aged, and it's aged across the country. So even the people that we've brought in are leaving, and yet we've had a constant production.
So follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Follow-up. So this shortage of physicians will become more critical.
Yes.
And then what is the recipe that we have to do as a legislator? And then my quick thought is maybe retiring physicians might be able to work part-time, maybe one solution, or give more duties to the nurses, even though we have nurses shortage. And which directions do we need to move in the future?
I applaud every direction that you've mentioned and think we need to follow up in each vein. The reason that we would be interested in building a trans-professional school is so that we can distribute the work in the best possible manner. There is so much work out there, there is no room for parochialism about who should do what. So that's one aspect. When we have to learn to do this in teams, we have to redefine in some ways how healthcare is provided. We also, in the same spirit of the bill that Representative Greenlick is bringing forward, we have to work with institutions around the state. This is not just an OHSU or an OH issue or an OHSU-centric problem, and it isn't just in physicians. It's in every one of the healthcare professions, and that's why we do have to coordinate our efforts with the other institutions, and we have to work together to leverage those resources.
Just a comment. And I heard there has been a strike, a physician's strike in California. People lived longer after the doctor's strike.
Is that true or not? I don't know anything
about it. Isn't that people live longer? Is that the death rate dropped?
Is that right?
During the time of the strike, yes, in California and in Israel both.
Okay.
You're not, it was because guys like Joe couldn't do surgery.
That was, I just have one question as we wrap up here. In terms of the remarkable increase in research funding from 2000 to 2005, can your institution sustain that sort of growth or sustain even the level that you've reached at this point?
I hate to give short answers because they can be quoted out of context, but the honest answer is we cannot sustain that. We cannot, without a fundamental change in our basic operating budget. We will continue to look for ways to be more efficient. We will continue to be creative in looking for new sources of revenues, but the hard, cold truth is that we cannot.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you so much.
This chart is an important chart because it shows the total research dollars increased five times from 1990 to now. If we were to increase now, it would take it to $1 billion, which right. I don't think anybody's at $1 billion. I'm not close. It's a huge accomplishment.
Doctor, thank you so much for coming and presenting the information to us, and thank you so much for your work. Best of luck as we continue forward.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the support.
And to close the informational hearing on Oregon Health Science University, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on two bills, House Bill 2633 and House Bill 2845. And I believe we have Representative Hunt here to introduce these bills. And as he is getting ready, I'll ask Mr. Olson to review both proposals for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2633 specifies the type of schools at which the Department of Human Services may provide vocational rehabilitation training. There's a -1 amendment which would change provide to refer a person to and clarify that in addition to schools would also include programs and registered apprenticeship programs as well. And you have the -1 amendment before you. For House Bill 2845, allow the Department of Education to conduct financial audit of career schools, prohibit career schools from including an arbitration clause in student enrollment agreement, increasing annual fees for career school licensure, requiring the superintendent of public instruction to complete investigation of complaints against career schools within 60 days of commencing investigation, and specify maximum civil penalties that may be collected from career schools for certain violations. The -2 amendment to this bill before you has a number of changes, namely would clarify that it would be the Secretary of State or private entities to do the auditing, not the Department of Education. Clarify that the kind of arbitration is binding arbitration, which is prohibited. Changes the fee raise schedule to there would still raise the fees, but not as much on the lower income-generating schools. And change some of the deadlines for handling complaints and clarify some others concerning imposition of civil penalty. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Hunt, welcome to the Subcommittee on Higher Education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. This appreciate you having this hearing on both House Bills 2845 and 2633. The bills before you today really came out of the whole experience that we experienced as local communities and as a state when the Business Computer Training Institute closed their doors. That career school was headquartered in the state of Washington, but had campuses here in Salem as well as in Beaverton. You may or may not be aware that career schools are legally allowed to accept up to 85% to 90% of their total tuition dollars from federal grants and loans. BCTI recruiters intentionally sought out low-income people who could qualify for the maximum amount of federal aid out of unemployment offices, one-stop centers, and other locations. In fact, their large team of recruiters actually went out and used high-pressure sales tactics, including home visits, free rides to the campus, follow-up calls. You'll hear a lot of those stories today, as well as a lot of the resulting negative impacts of the students' experience with that particular school. A lot of attention was focused by the media and others on the experience of that school, and really on really students who were down on their luck being promised the world, being promised that they'd have high paying careers in the computer industry, and then only end up working back at a fast food restaurant after graduation. The standard courses offered at BCTI are listed there on my testimony. They included the following training, things like resume writing skills, job interview training, job finding skills, typing skills, Microsoft Office training. BCTI offered this training over a four-month period and charged about $10,000. If students were unable to cover the additional out-of-pocket costs, BCTI offered their own lending services. So it was students got interest rates as high as 20%. So you've got a dynamic where they're drawing in lots of federal student financial aid, where the students are getting federal loans, and then they're getting additional loans from the institution directly, and they're being left without a degree, without actual skills that they can employ in the workforce. As a comparison, so again, that model with BCTI was about $10,000. As a comparison, students could access very similar training at Chemeketa Community College, located across the street from the former BCTI campus, for about $1,100, all of which could be covered with a federal loan or grant program. Now, fortunately, eventually, Ray Lindley and the staff of the Department of Education did put a stop to BCTI's questionable practices. I do want to commend Ray and his staff for their hard work during this process, as well as their guidance for us as we probed them about ways to address this situation. But very frankly, they did not have the staff nor the authority to be able to intervene in this kind of a situation. Eventually, after there were lots of complaints and lots of problems and lots of media attention, eventually they were shut down. But I believe we need to act much more aggressively and much more proactively so this kind of a situation doesn't occur again. House Bill 2845 has four major components. Explicitly stating in statute that the department has the authority to request audits of career schools. Currently, they do have the authority in rule. This would actually put it in statute. So there'd be no argument from any career school about whether or not they had the statutory authority to proceed. There is an issue, frankly, with the way it is currently drafted in the -2 amendments, where you note that the Department of Education may direct the Secretary of State. We cannot have one department directing the Secretary of State. That particular language will not work. So you will be seeing another amendment come forward in the next few days. The second major component is prohibiting career schools from including binding arbitration agreements in their enrollment clauses in their enrollment agreements. Basically, before students sign up, many of them actually require students to say, we will agree to binding arbitration. Fortunately, this has not been a major issue in Oregon yet, but it has been in other states. We're trying to get ahead of the curve on that one. Third, increasing the actual licensing fees that are charged to these career schools, frankly, in order to provide the resources for the department to be able to much more proactively investigate, carry out the state's responsibility in regulating the career schools industry. This additional person will not only be helpful in the administrative task of licensing the new schools up front, so we don't end up with bad actors being licensed in the first place, but also in overseeing that the schools are legitimately serving Oregon students. And the fourth provision is revising the student complaint process by adding a requirement that the Department of Education must notify students within 30 days that they have received their complaint. That section also has an increase in the fines assessed for violations. These fines are rarely assessed and flow into the general fund, so there's really no incentive for the department to issue those fines in order to access more money. The second bill, House Bill 2633, is a much more simpler approach. It's an effort to ensure that Oregon's vocational rehab dollars are actually flowing to those programs that the state has sanctioned. You can see how those are laid out in sections 1 through 6 in the bill, and then a seventh section in the -1 amendment. The real intent here is to make sure that there is a baseline of quality for these programs, and that we're not giving away state voc rehab dollars to programs that are not really legitimately providing voc rehab kind of training. I understand that the Department of Human Services may have some potential concerns about this. Just heard about this earlier today. And would be happy to work with them to draft any amendments to address those concerns. The private career schools industry has clearly exploded in Oregon. When we first drafted this bill in 2005, the state had licensed approximately 250 schools. 2 years later, we're up to over 300 schools. This is a burgeoning industry, and in a lot of cases, it's providing very valuable post-secondary training. to students to give them an edge in the job market and the workforce. On the whole, I think they do provide an important service. The challenge is, how do we make sure that the bad actors are not allowed to run away? Clearly, this industry has had a history of several bad actors. That's been true nationally. That's been true in Oregon. I believe that as a state, we really need to step up and embrace our responsibility to make sure that these bad actors are not going to, first of all, harm students, and second of all, give a bad name to all the legitimate actors in the career school arena. I really appreciated the assistance and input of some of the long-term career schools in Oregon in drafting this bill and the amendments, and look forward to continuing to work with them. And would be happy to stop there and answer any questions of which I am able. You've got an expert from the Department of Education who will be up on your agenda later. And so, Mr. Chair, you can save your difficult questions for him and ask me the easy ones.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions, gentlemen? Representative Greenock.
Representative Hunt, is there a way a prospective student can find out whether the school they want to go to is legitimate and does what it promises to do? Is there any central clearinghouse or something?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, that's a great question, which is probably better asked to Ray Lindley from the Department of Education. I think one of the challenges right now is, even as they have had complaints in the past, they have not had the capacity to investigate whether those complaints are legitimate or not. You'll have to ask him if they actually release that information about what complaints have been filed. But even if they do, it wouldn't provide much guidance for the student, because there wouldn't be the knowledge of whether that was a legitimate complaint or not. And so I'd probably just stop there.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, thanks for bringing this forward. You mentioned under House Bill 2845 in your second point on page 2 of your testimony with regards to binding arbitration. Can you give me an example or kind of explain that a little bit further? I'm not sure I understand how binding arbitration helps the school or helps the student or doesn't help the student or harms the student.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I'll take a shot at it. And in fact, you'll notice in the dash one amendments, or the dash two amendments, I guess it is, we've specifically changed what was originally just any arbitration clause to just prohibiting a binding arbitration clause. So schools would still have the ability to go forward with an arbitration clause. It would be a fair process. I think there is real concern in a binding arbitration kind of process that students would be at a real disadvantage. You're dealing with a large school, in some cases a national school with lots of resources, and a individual student who doesn't have, you know, it's not like most of the cases where, you know, you as a former mayor might be dealing with a union in an arbitration situation. You've got counsel and backup. They've got counsel and backup. It's kind of a fair playing field. That would not be the case in this kind of a situation, where the student is really out there by themselves without any kind of backup. And the school, at least in the case of large schools like BCTI, has lots of resources, legal and otherwise. The concern about there being a binding arbitration clause is that leaves the student at a real disadvantage.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
And I know that you said that the dash twos are going to be turned into probably a dash three, because you can't direct the Secretary of State, they can only request. But with regards to having the Secretary of State or the Department of Education, for that matter, doing financial and program audits of these schools, who will pay for that, and who's going to be the client?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, as this is envisioned, the increased fees would fund that additional position within the department. I think there's a real question, as I've talked to some of the folks from some of these, again, long-term Oregon career schools, about whether that should be a true audit, kind of capital A audit, or whether that should be an aggressive financial review that might not meet the capital A audit standards. I think I'd be very interested in feedback from you all in terms of what they might do. The department could do a financial review. The department, as things are structured now in the state of Oregon, only the Secretary of State and the Audits Division could do an actual audit. But that would be funded under this bill by an increased assessment on the schools. Frankly, several of the schools have stepped up and said, we recognize there are some problems with bad actors in this industry. We want to make sure we've got a well-regulated industry so that, that those of them who are actually providing legitimate training for students are able to proceed and continue to serve those students without having a bad name attributed to the whole industry. So those additional fines on the school, excuse me, those additional fees up front in terms of licensing of the schools would fund that additional position in the department.
And so, if I may, Mr. Chair, so who will the client be?
The client, well, if the review is being done by the Department of Education, they would be the one who would be in response to complaints or in response to concerns that they've seen. They would be doing the review themselves. If it's the desire of you all to have it be a full audit, that would be done by the Secretary of State with the department as the client.
Just as a side note, Mr. Chair, if you anticipate the department to be the client, you better put it actually in the statute. Because and then the other thing is that I think that we have a little bit of a problem with having the Secretary of State's office be auditing private enterprise that way. I don't know. Maybe we don't. But I would think that that's going to create a little bit of a problem. But the client is if you ask the Division of Audits about this, they will tell you that the client is the auditee or the person, the group being audited. So if you're going to audit BCTI, which no longer exists, but let's say you're going to audit Pioneer Pacific, which is in my district, then Pioneer Pacific would be the client. And they're the ones that are going to get the information first. They're the ones that are going to have the opportunity to respond to the things that are put into the audit. So if you want to have either the legislature or the Department of Education as the client or one of the clients, you probably are going to have to specify that.
Thanks for that suggestion.
Representative Clem.
I just wanted to speak for just a brief moment. I think Ray will probably be able to help us out on a lot of these questions. When I was chair of OSAC, we regulate private enterprise all the time. We accredit them. We go in and audit their program offerings to make sure they offer the correct types of, we had an issue where we even had to figure out how to deal with religious schools who were ending up with their credential being offered up as a public credential. It originally wasn't intended to be that way, but we didn't want to audit religious schools for them training their own ministers. We sort of figured that was their business. But the statute made that a degree coming out of a religiously exempt, accredited or unaccredited because they're religiously exempt, it came out that you could use that to get any job. So we had to go back and redevise the whole system because we didn't really want government intruding on religious practices. So it happens now. We just don't get into the books as much as we do what courses are offering, whether they're faculty or legitimate, you know, whether they're holding X percentage of degrees and that kind of thing. One thing just to note as we go forward, the Oregon Opportunity Grant does not allow for-profit nor any entity that's not headquartered in Oregon into the state financial aid pool. Partially, and I resisted, I voted 4 or 5 times against changing that myself on the commission because of these types of things. BCTI is right on the edge of my district. I even spoke at it once as a computer guy. They asked me to come and speak to the students and sort of think about now some of those people that I spoke to. I mean, it was 6 months later that they shut it down, and the debts they may be incurring is disheartening.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hunt, thank you for bringing the bill forward. Just a comment on the use of the phrase bad actors. We don't want that in Oregon in any way, shape, or form. Representative Crum has one more question.
One more question real quick. On the front page of your testimony, Representative, you mentioned that a person could have gone across the street from BCTI here in Salem over to Chemeketa Community College for an estimated $1,100 for whatever training they would have wanted. Do you suppose that the career schools, it's a little bit of buyer beware? I mean, in other words, we make choices about where we want to go to school, whether it be to, you know, a career school or a community college or a university or a combination thereof. And I'm just wondering if there isn't a little bit of buyer beware, and also, you know, as a prospective student, sort of checking out all of your options.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, I think absolutely there, especially the way we function today, the responsibility really is completely on the students to investigate those things. I think that's the intent of this, is to find some greater balance. There will always be some element of responsibility on the students to make sure they're investigating to whatever degree they're capable the places where they're going to be spending their money and borrowing other money to spend. I think my hope is that we provide at least some more resources for them, both to have knowledge, in response to Representative Greenlee's earlier question, knowledge of what is actually happening with the schools out there, some protections from bad schools ever getting licensed in the first place, and where there is maybe a good school that's gone bad over time, that there is an investigation and some aggressive oversight over them to make sure that they don't continue to harm students long term. But I would agree completely that there is some responsibility that will always lie with the student. Unfortunately, today I think that's all the responsibility.
Of course, I would also point out, Mr. Chair, that a lot of the folks that go to career schools many times are sort of workforce reentries, or they're trying to get reenter the workforce, and so they're not the 17 and 18 year olds directly out of high school that, you know, still haven't figured out which year to drive first. They're 30, 35, 40, 45 year olds that are going back because they've decided to change careers or whatever else. And so you would think that having that added responsibility probably wouldn't be as much of a burden on the more mature, although maybe they're just chronologically mature and not.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would like to comment on that. I was going to ask a question is whether the Attorney General's office has dealt with their unfair trade practices division, because, I mean, the underlying rule that allows caveat emptor to work is that there be protections from fraud, that there be open information in the marketplace, and that everybody has access to that information, that if be decent and honest information. I mean, I hear things here at least bordering on fraud, if not outright fraud. It seems to me that's what these bills are trying to get at. How do we protect innocent buyers in the marketplace from being offered fraudulent goods?
I think back to the financial aid part, part of the problem is it's not their money. And so it becomes their money later, but in your, you know, when you're being pitched in a Washington Square Mall at the food court by somebody, hey, free government money, you know, they mislead people all the time. So I think there really is fraud that occurs probably. But when it's a grant of $3,500 by the federal government, and they gear their whole business model at attracting those grants, you know, the person says, yeah, sure, I guess if I'm eligible. And again, that's why we didn't allow them into the pool at all in Oregon, because we say, you know, if you want to go through and actually be part of our grant, then we're not so sure how well for-profit works in the educational model in that regard. We're not so comfortable on even people whose headquarters are outside of Oregon, so we have no leverage over them that we have in other ways because of their business licenses and other things we have. You know, and we had commissioners who felt like we went a little too far. We were a little too tight on that to not allow, you know, any non-Oregon headquartered or any for-profit, even the reputable ones. But I didn't, because I saw the gaming going on in the system to basically just drag in federal dollars. And it was a, you know, a shell game that didn't have anything to do with education. You found out later, but you didn't know that up front. It just seemed like, well, they all seem to all qualify for financial aid. How great, they're serving low-income people. And then you get into their memos and you find out they're actually targeting and doing that on purpose.
Right.
Yeah.
Federal government certified them.
Right.
Well, very good. It's an interesting bill. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Bravo, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Obviously, we need certified.
Gentlemen, at this point, we have a witness who might testify via phone, and Mr. Olson is going to try to get the. Can you describe who this person is, dear?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The next witness is a gentleman named Darrell Cochran, who's an attorney in Washington State who was on the case involving BCTI. If the committee can bear with me for just a minute, we're going to bring him on speakerphone, but they are pulling him out of a meeting, so this will take just 1 minute.
Dial away.
There is a website where there is like really good information on graduates that you can contact. And you see, like, well, yeah, even because we're
committee members in the speakerphone.
Sure, you know, steps to the
Hi, this is Derek Olson from the Oregon House Education Committee. Can you please page Heather Spencer?
1 moment.
You would not believe in the offshore, just all the mail arena, some of the stuff we dealt with. These Ozarks, right? The cruiser was sort of amazing. Ozarks, the Rangers. And you know, we got sued a bunch of times.
I'm not getting a response to that. Would you like voicemail?
No, we will call back in just a couple minutes and see if we can find her available then. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest we call the next panel of witnesses, and then we could try Mr. Cochran afterwards.
Would you announce the names of the next panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a couple students and instructors who wish to testify. Janelle Schultes, Edward James, and Darcy Pelser.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, I can go first. My name is Darcy Pelser, and I'm a former instructor of BCTI, and I'm the one that filed the complaint that ended in their ultimate demise. And I just wanted to share with you the story that what led me to filing the complaint. I taught the last phase of the program. Students finishing my class graduated from what was considered the first phase, and it was the more basic computer skills, Microsoft Office type stuff. There was a second phase of the program that got into more technical hardware type stuff, but I wasn't involved in that. So in my class, a student by the name of Harold Bruce Tate, he had progressed to my class, and it became aware to me immediately that he had some pretty severe mental disabilities. And I wasn't sure if he had Alzheimer's, he was fairly old, or some sort of a traumatic brain injury, but I knew for certain he should not be enrolled in the program because he couldn't remember my name on a day-to-day basis, he couldn't remember how to turn on the computer, and basically he was just sitting in a chair not doing anything. And when I brought this to the attention of my supervisors, they suggested that I give him credit for his work, just an attempt to do the work, not necessarily knowing the skills or being able to complete the tasks that I was asking him to do. And I refused to do that. When I looked over his records, every teacher prior to me in the previous classes had given him 100%. And graduate services were trying to enroll him in the second phase of the program, which would have been another $10,000. And once I realized I wasn't getting anywhere with the staff and my direct supervisors there at BCTI, I found another job and tried to contact as many people as I possibly could, hoping that he wouldn't. I knew he was graduating on June 11th, and I think my last day there was in May sometime, and so I was in a hot pursuit to get somebody to pay attention to the situation, at which point I got in touch with Ray Lindley and filed a complaint that way. So I did wind up going to the graduation, and they handed him an honorary certificate because I had CC'd their accrediting agency, who didn't respond to my initial complaint, but I CC'd them on email I sent to the Department of Justice, Federal Department of Education, as well as the Oregon Department of Education, and I heard through the rumor mill that their accrediting agency called them and told them that they could not graduate him. So at the graduation ceremony, even though the school didn't know I had got the wheels turning on this, I watched them hand him an honorary certificate of completion.
Thank you very much. Can you give me the name of the accrediting agency?
Yeah, ASSET. It's ACCET, and I believe they're located on the East Coast. ASSET.org is their website.
Thank you very much.
Please. I'm Janelle Schultes. I'm from Albany, and I'm a 1999 graduate from BCTI. My whole purpose for going to BCTI was to be able to get out there into the workforce and earn a better living to provide for my three children. I've been a single mom for many years, worked minimum wage jobs, unfortunately jobs with no benefits, which we all know in these days we need. I was recruited outside of our local employment office in 1998 by a young man who couldn't say enough about BCTI, what a great program it was, and that if I wanted a brighter future for myself and my children, that I needed to consider this. I did call the school when I got home that day and made an appointment to go up and see the campus for what it was. And I did end up signing up. Regretfully, I did end up signing up. They did focus on interviewing resumes, Microsoft Office suite, and friendship, which really struck me as odd, but they really, really honed in. Make friends with your classmates and the other people in the school. These people are here to support you. We're here to support you. It's like, great. It kind of seemed like a big, happy family. When she was interviewing me, she asked me some very personal questions, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I really believe it was to get into my head and find my weaknesses and really honed in on them. I spent 7.5 months there. I dedicated every single day that I needed to that school. I was an excellent student. I graduated top of my class. I received the highest honor in the school, well, that the school offered. When I graduated, I spent months looking for work. I ended up in a part-time temporary position. Unfortunately, like I said, that's temporary. So I ended up getting one more part-time temporary position. I worked for a total of 3 months out of my first year after I graduated. I've had no success since getting into any kind of clerical work. When I spoke to the school about this, they said, well, possibly your resumes. I did send my resumes up there to have them reviewed, and she sent me back resumes that had a lot of falsehoods on them. I could not give these to employers. I wouldn't be representing myself appropriately. When going in for interviews, this is what we were given to show potential employers. These are our certificates of completion and attendance and merit. They're useless. They have all the bells and whistles, apples and school buses, inappropriate to take in to anyone. Even if you took that in conjunction with your work that you did very well on, you mentioned the name BCTI and they'd all get a grin on their face and just kind of smirk. I spent a lot of time trying to get something done about this school, and I'm very happy to be here today and hope that it does get done. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair, Mr. Buckley, member representative, thank you for the opportunity to allow me to be here today. I attended school when I was 18 years of age. That was back in 2000. I was approached outside of the employment office.
You have to tell us what your name is.
Oh, for the record, yeah, my name is Edward C. James, and I reside here in Salem, Oregon.
Thank you.
I'm kind of here.
That's fine.
Okay. Yeah, they approached me and told me about it. I told them I wasn't interested. I was going to attend ITT Tech, and they told me, well, you know, there are about 2 or 4 years. You know, you can get it down here for 7 months. And I said, wow. So they brought me into it. At that time, I didn't know much about the when schools obtain their, you know, certification or whatever you call it, they are not even they don't even have national or regional, which is the highest. Basically, it's a useless program. At that time, I didn't know, and I noticed something really fishy was going on. A couple of students were coming under the influence. I tried recording it, and they said, "Oh, you're just same things, man. You know, there's no way you can prove it. As long as we cannot prove it, you know, we can't keep the students out. Yes. And basically the problem is way too expensive. Our $10,000, like they said, you know, you can do that education for a fraction of a price at Jamaica, or you can do self-paced on technical certifications that are actually accepted by the state of Oregon for about $1,500.
Very good. Questions? Representative Klim.
I have a question for the two students. Did they, as part of the process of recruiting or talking to you, sort of ask you about your income or have you fill out a FAFSA and make you go through it?
Yes, they did ask about my income.
Do you have any, Mr. Wolfram, do you have any experience, anybody else you know that maybe made a little too much money or maybe even a teacher? Do you know what the treatment was like of people who wouldn't be eligible for financial aid? Did you ever hear any stories about that?
I believe, and this is not based on fact at all, but it was my understanding that people who didn't weren't eligible for federal financial aid could easily get a loan through BCTI, some private lender, and at outrageous interest rates. So,
I'll ask the students, did you, before you enrolled, did you ask for graduates, a record of their graduates and where their graduates are working?
Yes. I did, and they told me about a couple of stories of people making $15, $13 an hour. And they said, oh, one got a pretty good job. He's making about $35,000. So I just took their word for it, you know.
I have something to say on that note. I also watched them create fake businesses for students to be employed by, such as, like, if a student... the graduate services had to place a student in a job or place them in the second phase of the program in order to meet their quota. And if students weren't able to find a job or talked about maybe creating, you know, their own landscaping company, then they would say they were employed by their own name, incorporated, and then use that in their statistics to sell potential students on entering the program. Or, you know, working at Taco Bell using a computer.
Computerized register.
Wow.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. It's an amazing story. I'm sorry. I hope that that you can find some positive outcomes out of this and get. Are you? Do you have a job now? At present?
Nothing that BCTA had me. You know, for the job. I'm starting a technical career, but it's not in BCTA, that's for sure. And I'm finding that what I'm learning now, it's totally different from what they taught me. They taught me just a basic office skills, mm-hmm. which you can buy and also self-paced for about $500, $600, and you can learn a lot more. You can go to formative testing, get certified, and that would actually mean something to an employer.
Thank you all three for being here to tell the story, and I wish you best of luck in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson. Can you try again on the phone?
Or? Yes, Mr. Chair. We believe the attorney is available, so we'll try again. The previous one, Mr. Cochran.
Do we call collect on this? Give me a reason why they didn't take it.
Chair, I suggest we move to the next witness and try again.
Oh, very good. Who do we have up next, Mr. Olson?
I believe we should Ray Lindley from the Department of Education. Morgan Allen, I believe, is also with him.
Mr. Allen.
Good Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen, Legislative Director for the Department of Education. And we're here just, I believe you have a public hearing open on two bills, but we're here just to speak on 2845. And I'll keep my comments brief. We're supportive of House Bill 2845, and we just got a chance to take a look at the Dash 2 amendments and are going to work with Representative Hunt's office to make some improvements to those. And we appreciate the Superintendent Castillo is appreciative of Representative Hunt's staff who have sort of worked with us every step of the way to improve this language and make the bill workable. Before I turn it over to Ray Lindley, who's our director of the Office of Educational Improvement and Education and really responsible, I think, for shutting down BCTI here in Oregon, just to give you a little background on why we're supportive of this bill. This is a tremendous growth industry. I think you heard Representative Hunt quote some statistics, and I was talking to Ray on the way over here today. And 3 years ago when this issue, or excuse me, you know, 2 years ago when this issue first came up, we had about 225 or 230 of these career schools in Oregon. And just 2 years later, we have 305 accredited and licensed institutions in our state. And Ray told me he has five applications on his desk for five more schools to open up right now, just waiting to be worked on. So the one thing I wanted to mention was there were some questions about the fee structure in the bill. And it's our understanding, working with Representative Hunt's office and talking to some of the folks at the career schools, that they were looking to a fee structure that would raise enough money so that the department could get position authority to add an education specialist to help with the licensing process and monitoring complaints and making sure that these kinds of things don't happen again. And I believe a quick calculation based on the number of schools currently in Oregon today, we did some quick penciling out, it's somewhere around $87,000 a year for that fee increase, that graduated fee increase that's contained in the Dash 2 amendments. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Lindley, and he can answer any questions about the BCTI case specifically, but probably more importantly, you might just have some general questions about what's going on with this industry in Oregon and the types of things that we do at the Department of Education. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Lindley.
Mr. Lindley, we're going to ask you to pause. You better hear the whisper. We're going to try this phone number one more time and see if we get an answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, this witness has a short time window, and I think we have a better number to reach him on now.
It's Heather.
Heather, this is Derek Olson from the House Education Committee. You're on speakerphone in the committee. We are trying to reach Mr. Cochran, please, to testify.
One moment, please.
Thank you.
This is Daryl Cochran.
Mr. Cochran, hello. Good afternoon. This is Derek Olson. I'm the committee administrator with the Oregon House Education Committee, the Subcommittee on Higher Education. You're currently on speakerphone in front of the public hearing we're having on House Bill 2845 regarding the oversight and auditing of career schools in Oregon.
Great.
We'd like you, if you could please state your name and location for the record, and then we invite you to testify. And the committee is chaired by Representative Buckley.
Thank you. My name is Daryl Cochran. I am an attorney, and I am currently in Tacoma, Washington. And Chair Buckley and the representatives, thank you for the opportunity to testify and to do so by telephone. I have a baby daughter who is 1 centimeter more of dilation away from taking her journey into the world, so my wife put me on house arrest for the moment. I wanted to testify, and especially in person, because I think this vocational school legislation is a very important safeguard for Oregon residents. I currently represent 28,000 former students of the Business Computer Training Institute, or BCTI, which is a private vocational school that operated campuses, if you can call them that, in Beaverton and Salem. And the type of legislation discussed here today could have given the Oregon Department of Education the resources it needed to prevent these former students from suffering what our economists have calculated at millions of dollars in damages. And you may have heard testimony already this afternoon about it, but if not, I'll give you a little background. BCTI was a corporation, a for-profit vocational school that literally manipulated all the rules for vocational schools to enable it to draw about $25 million in revenue per year in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And that money came almost entirely from federal loans and grants made to the students who BCTI signed up. Now, in theory, BCTI offered computer training to students for both entry-level computer jobs and then an advanced course. And each course was a 30-week course, and each session cost $10,000. So that if you attended both the beginning course and the advanced course, you would owe BCTI or the federal government $20,000. And for those of us who've gone through higher education, we know that $20,000 buys a lot of top-notch schooling at schools like the University of Oregon and Oregon State, or a lot of the other higher education institutions in Oregon. But BCTI wasn't targeting, discriminating folks like ourselves for their program. They would set up recruiters outside of welfare offices, unemployment offices, the social and health services offices, or even shopping malls, so that they could isolate likely targets who would succumb to a hard sell. And these recruiters and telemarketers who BCTI hired would not only do the hard sell, but would really usher people right into the building and sign them up for student loans. Now, the key to making $25 million in revenue for a year was literally to sign up as many living and breathing humans as possible and get them signed up and do an application to the federal government for $10,000 student loans. And then BCTI would need to keep these students in classes long enough so that the federal government would send checks for the tuition. So what we've found out through about a year and a half of litigation in a class action lawsuit up here in Washington State is that the classes BCTI would have had nothing to do with computer training and had everything to do with making it fun enough for kind of low social income class folks, make it fun enough to keep their interest so that they would stay in school long enough to get the checks. And the BCTI administrators who were up here in Pierce County, Washington, they would reward their employees for keeping their student retention rates high. And that means that as long as they could keep students in class long enough to get the checks, the BCTI administrators would give bonuses and free trips away to those recruiters and instructors who could do that. And what that ended up doing was incentivizing bad behavior by instructors and recruiters so that they would violate the rules about how close they could get to welfare offices, or even to the point where they were falsifying admissions tests, they were falsifying attendance records, and falsifying test results. All of that in order to keep students in the classes as long as they could to get the loan checks. I happened to be in BCTI's warehouse of documents the other day. They closed down shortly after the Oregonian published a series of articles about the Department of Oregon or the Department of Education in Oregon, their investigation of BCTI. They closed down the shops after that, but they were forced by a court up here to retain all the records. I was going through all of their original files the other day, and I got a chance to review the one really infamous case from the Beaverton campus, which was the story of a student whose name, his initials were HT, who had a college education at some point in his life. He was in his 60s and then had a brain injury subsequently. Anyway, BCTI recruiters found him, got him to sign up for the basic course for $10,000. They passed him through his courses in the basic program, even though he couldn't remember what happened the prior day on any subsequent day, so that he couldn't even remember how to open Microsoft Windows on any given day during the course. But they graduated him on the basic course, and then they convinced him, or they got him, to sign up for the advanced course, which was another $10,000, and it was sometime in that second program that an instructor at the Beaverton campus turned BCTI in for what was happening. She couldn't tolerate it anymore, and she reported it to the Department of Oregon Education. The director, Ray Lindley, there began to investigate and really set the ball rolling for shutting down BCTI. So those are the kind of abuses that are out there potentially. BCTI obviously represents probably the worst of the worst, but the proposals which have been made in House Bill 2845 are important to give the resources to an education department like Oregon so that they can make sure that this doesn't happen again. And Chair Buckley and members, I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill.
Mr. Corker, thank you so much. We're all on pins and needles here about the baby coming, too, so best of luck with that. Any questions, gentlemen? We greatly appreciate your time, and we wish you the best of luck with the birth.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so Goodbye. Much.
Thank you, Mr. Cochran.
I'm Ray Lindley from the Oregon Department of Education. You've heard my name a few times today. And I would like to, first of all, express my deep appreciation to Representative Hunt and his staff for taking this issue on. We have been licensing private career schools in Oregon. We were trying to find out how long it's been. I believe it's been at least since the early 50s. And as has been pointed out today, it has grown greatly in the last few years as more people are entering the job market. As I think, as Representative Clem pointed out, many of the people are re-entering the job market and they're retraining for jobs that other than those for which they trained or studied initially. If I could, I would like to just divide a couple of comments, one into the BCTI issue, which is the one that I'm sure brought this to Representative Hunt and his staff's attention. It is most of everything you've heard today we have experienced in living color, and it was definitely not a pleasant time in our lives when we began hearing the stories such as you've heard today. I would like to point out that this is an anomaly and that most all of our career schools are very, very respectable and do an outstanding job. And as has been pointed out, you can go to a private career school, which usually is focused just on that career, and it does cost more because it is private industry. And or you can go to a community college for many of the programs that are offered in private career schools. However, there are many programs that private career schools offer that are not offered in community colleges. So I generally say that a private career school is more expensive and shorter, and a community college is usually less expensive and longer. That's not always true, but generally that's how we look at it. But I do want to say that we spent a lot of time over the BCTI issue. I have always felt, and even though I never met her before today, that Darcy Pelser was the first person who really had the courage to put in writing what we have been hearing. And you know, I know that you spoke in regard to the binding arbitration issue with a very wealthy school being able to afford many things. Well, that was the case with BCTI when people attempted to file complaints and so forth. They had the money to hire attorneys, and most students don't have the money to hire attorneys, and that's one of the reasons these issues wouldn't get there to us. And we heard stories, but to try to pin it down, I hope you can understand that we do have to have some reason to investigate. And it wasn't until the Darcy Pelser complaint that I felt we had solid information that we could do the investigation. That went on for several months before they closed down. So those are my BCTI issues. However, Representative Hunt and his staff's bill speaks more to the issue of how we need to be working more diligently at the Department of Education to monitor these schools. Currently, we have five different people who are involved in some portion of their job in monitoring of career schools. However, when you count the FTE for those five people, we all do many other things. The FTE for singly devoted to private career schools is 1.80. So we have less than two full-time people who are investigating and monitoring the schools. This would be a tremendous boost to us. The other thing, although we're certainly waiting for this committee and the legislature to tell us whether or not the position authority and the bill passes, one of the things that we are really considering is that we would like to hire someone who has more expertise in financial records, because that is an area that most educators do not have as much training as we would like to have, and we believe that if we could spend more time actually looking at those financial documents when they come in, that we can do a better job in helping the schools. The other thing that I wanted to point out was the question about financial audits. We currently have an Oregon administrative rule that says we have the right to require a privately financed financial audit. In other words, the school pays for the audit. And if it is a Title IV school that is eligible for federal financial aid, which BCTI was, and which obviously Representative Clem knows about, if we require it, they must provide it. And as far as the United States Department of Education, there is a list of certified public accountants. They will recognize their audits. So it's not just any CPA who can do this for federally financed schools that receive federal financing for their students. So I believe that the financial audit portion of the bill will easily be covered with what is being presented here. And I think if I could just move back, I just looked at my notes. There was one more thing that I wanted to say about BCTI, and I think Mr. Cochran pointed to it, and definitely one of the students pointed to it today. BCTI, which I said was an anomaly, they really concentrated on what we call soft skills. And one of the students said something about feeling good and being nice to each other and so forth and writing resumes. Those are nice, soft skills. However, what I believe students of Oregon should expect is hard skills. In other words, do you really know how to work the computer? Can you program a computer and so forth? And that is the kind of thing that will help you get a job. You might get in the door with the soft skills, but if you don't know the things. And I was glad to hear the students say it, because as we began investigating and looking deeper, we did find that some of the placements that BCTI had made for their students were shadow corporations. They didn't exist. And also, when they said they were working at a company, when we found out exactly what the job was as part of our investigation, we did. We not only heard of the 7-Eleven story, but we had an ARCO service station attendant, and the rationale was because you have to push the buttons on the gas pump, that is a computer, and therefore you've used your computer skills. So I don't want to overly emphasize the BCTI thing. Hopefully that is that is behind all of us. I am aware of about approximately $25 million a year that they received in federal financial aid, and it is true that in many cases they had an internal loan to make up for the other percentage that federal financial aid wouldn't cover, and the internal loan was from another corporation operated by the BCTI people, and so they were actually loaning their own money, and they still attempted to collect it even after the school closed. And so we've done everything we can to legally stop that. And yet we do have many, many students, as Mr. Cochran pointed out in the class action lawsuit in Washington, who are really, they have their certificates, they've completed, but they're finding the job market just isn't there for the training they've received. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Ms. Lynn, thank you so much. Gentlemen, we have just a few minutes. We have two more witnesses to get to. If you have a very short question, I'd be glad to entertain it.
Just one question. I don't know the history of your budget as well as I did the OSAC Office of Degree Authorization, but over the last 4 years, did you also suffer significant general fund declines, or were you not so much general funded in the past? I think your counterpart had about a 70% decline in general fund for the purpose of making sure degrees were, you know, appropriate and being used, but I wonder what yours was like.
Okay. Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, we do not get any general funds for the operation of our office.
Mr. Chair, I have two questions that, and Mr. Lindley, if you want to respond later in writing, that would be fine. How many schools do we think currently are bad actors out there? And the other question is, you mentioned the ability to do the to require the audits, and it's by rule. What statutory authority is that rule written under, and what's the rule number?
Chair Buckley, Representative Cromwell, we only have an Oregon administrative rule, and I can give it to you. It is Oregon Administrative Rule 581-045-0032, number 1, number 1H. Schools that are accredited and offer students Title IV financial aid shall submit an audited financial report signed by an independent certified public accountant. And may I just further say that we have in another rule, which has to do with complaints and investigation, and I will look up the number for you, but it says that a private career school must provide any information that we request, and we do ask a lot of things. That's the second part of your question. The first part of your question was, how many schools do we have now that are what we consider bad actors? I currently have one school that I just took off of probation last week. They've been on their probation since January of 06, and I have worked very hard to get them to straighten out. Their issue wasn't the same as BCTI, but it was still mismanagement of administrative practices. And I currently, in addition to that one, which I think we finally have straightened out, we have two schools that were doing a pretty extensive complaint investigation, and I just sent a letter over to the department's attorney general this morning with a requested penalty for this school because of not treating students in student enrollment agreements properly. So I would say three.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Ed, thank you for coming forward. Thank you for your work. I just want to emphasize two things that you said. First, that we do need all the credible workforce training that we can get in our state. And that's a very valid point. And also that that Darcy Pelser did a service to the state of Oregon by coming forward, and we're grateful for that.
Mr. Chair, just to have one quick question.
Very quick.
And I'm hearing so bad stories about BCTI, but did they any good in the past for the student? Anything they have done good? What they did, all bad or any good at all?
Chair Buckley, Representative Lim, that's a hard question to answer. I'm sure that every school in relationships with students will have some good feelings. We have not seen any evidence of the training that they gave that really was preparing them for the jobs that they said they would prepare them to do. You've heard two examples today. I would assume, although unfortunately we always hear the complaints and we don't often have people calling us saying, hey, I had a wonderful time, and we do tend to hear the negative, and so that's mainly what I've heard. We did send out a survey to as many former and current students as possible during our investigation, and we received a lot of information back, and there was very little that was positive, but most of what you've heard today and many other stories were told in the surveys that we sent out to the graduates and current students.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wilson, would you call up our last two witnesses for today?
Yes, if you could please come up together in the interest of time, since we're almost out of time. Stephanie Parrish Taylor from the Department of Human Services and Kathy McDonald from the Northwest Career College Federation.
My apologies for running late. We will make sure that we have time for written testimony if you need to submit that, or we can also call you back in when we pay attention to this bill again.
I'm Kathy McDonald, representing Northwest Career Colleges. Thank you so much, Representative Buckley and Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm here just to say that as a federation, we are in support of this bill. We look at this as tightening of the regulations does nothing but benefit all of us and makes us all better. So we want to thank Representative Hunt and his staff for the great work that they've done on this, and actually for allowing us to be a part of the conversation. We were very pleased with that. Hopefully we will have some students here giving you success stories on April 2nd. Mr. Olson is trying to work that out. We were here last week, but had some great success stories.
Correct.
You guys were detained. A couple of things that we did want to look at just to clarify and make sure in Section 2, Subsection 2, we just want to make sure that we understand that the financial audits are in the rules authority already. We understand that. We would just like to make sure that the person who's doing the audits is trained in financial audits and trained to do that, not just a staff person that would be filling in a position, and that the audits and the information of the financial institution are remain confidential. So we just want to make sure that stays as confidential information. In Section 8, the fee schedule, we're in support of the increase as long as it does go for the additional FTE for the staff person that we understand that we do need to provide that they are understaffed, and we appreciate the efforts to take care of that. And then the third thing, under Section 8, we just wanted to look at, we were a little concerned about the definition of violation, but we know that we're confident that it would be come out in Rules Committee, that it would be clarified, or just made sure that it was, we all were on the same page of that. So thank you. I know time is short, but we really appreciate the opportunity to tighten up the ship because it makes all of us better.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chairman Buckley and committee. For the record, I am Stephanie Parrish Taylor, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. I will not repeat my written remarks, but will just make several comments. I will say that the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation is in full support of the intent of this legislation of House Bill 2633. We unfortunately saw a number of students who had been failed by BCTI and our program and work with them to get other training, and in a number of instances those individuals experienced disabilities that were quite apparent and were not good predictors of success in that particular program. So again, we are in full support of the intent of this bill. Our concern is primarily with the definition of vocational rehabilitation training. As it's currently written, it would exclude some very specialized services and training we are able to do with individuals with more severe disabilities. Within the written testimony, we have made some recommendations about either adding or amending that definition. And I believe with those changes, we could fully support this bill.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate you bringing forth the proposed amendments to the bill, and I assume we'll be working with Representative Hunt's office on that prior to a work session. Thank you both very much for coming forward. If you have anything additional to communicate, please feel free to do so in the future. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on these two bills. 2845 and 2633. And if there's nothing else,
Mr. Chair,
close the public hearing on these two bills.
Before Mr. Lindley sneaks out the door, just the kind of work that he does, and also Alan Contreras, they sometimes take immense personal heat. Websites just devoted to slandering them, and I mean, it's really outrageous, especially, you know, I'm more familiar with Alan's work, which is the offshore degree diploma mills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I was named in a lawsuit, Alan was named in multiple lawsuits, and then they always give up because they can't win. But they're subject to great harassment by these entities for what they do, and it's obviously a public service type of job you're doing, and so I just want to commend you for it.
Thank you, Representative. With that, gentlemen, we are adjourned.